This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe.
Welcome to the Remarket Podcast for Friday, April 20th. I'm Megan Ubelacker, Marketplace's Senior Development Officer, which probably means nothing to you. Okay, what it means is I'm essentially the grant writer for Marketplace. So when you hear support for Marketplace's reporting comes from the Fill in the Blank Foundation, I'm the person who gets that support. As a fundraiser, I'm always interested in stories about both the haves and the have-nots. People who need help on one end of the spectrum, and at the other end of the spectrum, people that can give that help. And so one of the pieces that resonated with me this week was an interview on Marketplace Money with actor Wendell Pierce. Many of you know him as Bunk Moreland from The Wire, and he's doing something pretty unusual for an actor. He's starting a chain of supermarkets to help people who live in high-poverty neighborhoods get access to healthier food.
You loved him as Detective William Bunk Moreland on The Wire. You may also know him as the trombone-playing Antoine Batiste from HBO's Tremé. But actor Wendell Pierce has added a new role to his list of credits, one you probably will not find on IMDb. In December, he opened Sterling Express, the first in a chain of grocery stores called Sterling Farms. They sell fresh produce and other staples in his hometown of New Orleans, especially in the city's lower-income neighborhoods, which were pummeled by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Wendell Pierce, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tess.
Now, I was in New Orleans last fall, so 6 years post-Katrina, and this is something that can't help but strike you driving around parts of downtown, certainly the lower-income neighborhoods, the utter lack of both grocery stores and gas stations. How far do some folks have to go to get fresh food?
We haven't had a decent grocery store in the lower Ninth Ward in 20 years. People have to go, 45 minutes to get to a decent grocery store.
I first came upon this issue visiting about 3 years after Katrina, and the problem at the time, I think, was that stores didn't want to come back to New Orleans until people came back, and then a lot of people weren't going to come back to neighborhoods without infrastructure, including stores. Is that still part of the issue?
There's that catch-22, but now people have demonstrated that they're going to come back to New Orleans, that they have a loyalty to their neighborhoods, a loyalty to the city. The thing that's disappointing is the fact that you have American industry sitting on the sidelines. You take New Orleans East, for instance, where you have a populace with a median income of almost $50,000 per household, and they have to travel outside the city to go shopping. And that is unacceptable.
You mentioned that there are neighborhoods where, you know, folks are making a decent living, $50,000, and there's no grocery. But, I mean, I certainly noticed when I was there last fall that, for example, in the Garden District, where the average income is quite a bit higher, there's a Whole Foods there.
There's a Whole Foods. There's a Fresh Market. Rouse's has just come up with a beautiful grocery store in the CBD district. And I think that's all great. But like I tried to tell my fellow citizens uptown, poor people love Whole Foods, too. The recovery of New Orleans will be incomplete, you know, if it's just a portion of New Orleans. We have to be careful in New Orleans that we don't look at our recovery through rose-colored glasses and assume that the emperor has new clothes. We still have a lot of work to do.
What does it mean in a community when you don't have affordable places to shop for food?
First of all, it means that people are going to buy what they can get their hands on, and it's going to be processed, fast, unhealthy choices. And the thing that's kind of a paradox is the fact that actually the very cuisine that New Orleans is known for, the men and women from those communities created it, going back hundreds of years. But it was those working people that did it. And now that we're in this urban setting and they don't have access to those very tangible, fresh products. And it just means the children are going to be unhealthy. We have a pandemic of diseases from obesity, like diabetes here. And it actually has less to do with this, you know, wonderfully rich food that we have and has more to do with lesser access to fresh foods.
Why go into the grocery business? Why not try to use your celebrity bully pulpit to maybe convince the likes of Winn-Dixie to come back? Why start fresh for you?
Because Winn-Dixie left. Hmm. Our first store in Marrero is an old Winn-Dixie site. And now I can spend most of my time trying to convince others to do it or step into that void myself. Hmm. If not me, who? If not now, when? If not here, where? The other thing is, in difficult economic times, always invest in food. That's the one thing we can't go without.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a really good business decision. People have to eat or they die. Make it affordable. You know, there's going to be a need and a demand that's not going to go away. That's what sustenance is. And my mother grew up on a farm in Assumption Parish, which I own to this day, 14 acres of sugar cane. And they grew their own vegetables and raised chickens. And so I had that experience, the city boy that I was. And so as a business person also, as I was looking at all the pros and cons, that was one of the things that came to mind.
So you still have that farmland? You visit it? Do you
yes, I
plant
do.
Vegetables?
My aunt is there. I actually have a little vegetable garden right here in Pontchartrain Park.
Very nice.
My mother and I, that's our little shared experience. We have some mustard greens. we have some mustard greens in the backyard. It's great.
All right. I want you to make me some of those next time I visit New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a date.
Okay.
Some mustard greens from Bunk. But really, the question was asked to myself, you know, years from now, Wendell, when some kid walks up to you and says, Mr. Pierce, in New Orleans' darkest hours, right after Katrina, as we were trying to come back, what did you do? And I wanted to have an answer for that. And the thing that I realize now more than ever, as I become more of the American businessman and the capitalist, you can do well and do good. That's so evident when I think about doing business in New Orleans. And so those of you around the country and around the world who are listening to this, just from a businessman's perspective, in spite of everything that's happened to us, we're back.
Wendell Pierce, thank you.
Thank you, Tess.
Since I'm not typically the one coming up with stories at Marketplace, I went to Marketplace Money's senior producer, Patty Hirsch, to find out more about how this story went from a tiny bullet point on a brainstorm board to a piece that's ready for national broadcast. Hi, Patty.
Hello.
So how did this story come to your attention?
It came to my attention because we got a press release about Wendell Pierce's grocery store chain. So, you know, we were interested in that. Obviously, because, you know, he's Wendell Pierce. Actually, Tess is a big fan of his. I was a big fan of The Wire. So, you know, we're both big fans of his. But it was really interesting to hear about a guy who wanted to kind of leverage his star power to help people in a low-income neighborhood, which is what he's about with this chain of grocery stores.
Now, Marketplace Money is our personal finance program. How does this story fit into personal finance?
Well, it's about a store. It's a grocery store, right? It's one of the places that we attend. Most of us attend grocery stores more than we attend churches, I bet you, right? It's a grocery store for many people who are a religion. You know, you have all these people who just love their Whole Foods, they love their Trader Joe's or whatever it is. So, you know, grocery stores are all about personal finance. And particularly if you're in a food desert or a place, a low-income neighborhood where you don't have access to food, then a grocery store is a really, really important thing. You know, depending on how far away it is, you're going to be spending more money. Depending on what kind of things it stocks, you're going to be spending a certain amount of money. So it's actually all about personal finance.
You mentioned food desert, and that's something we've been hearing a lot about lately. And I've heard around the water cooler that Marketplace might be doing a little bit more coverage on this. Can you tell listeners a little bit what they might be hearing?
Yeah, so this week, the New York Times produced a report that cited three separate reports that have been written about food deserts. And essentially, they're saying that the concept of food desert it doesn't really exist in the way that we think about it. That, in fact, a lot of low-income neighborhoods aren't food deserts at all. They're actually more kind of food swamps, I think was the quote that the reporter used, because there are all sorts of restaurants in there. There are all sorts of bodegas. There is the ability. It is possible to find fresh food in these areas. But they tend not to have these kind of large grocery stores in the way that we think of, you know, like your Ralph's or your Trader Joe's or your Whole Foods or whatever it is. So that report was really kind of calling into question the food desert concept. So we have the reporter on the show this week. this weekend coming up to talk about what that food desert concept really means and to talk about, you know, whether or not there's a misconception there. And so Adrian Hill interviewed the reporter for the show.
Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you.
Another piece we did this week was focused on Louisiana and looked at some education reform being proposed there, which has the potential to have a deep impact on people in impoverished communities. Marketplace's education reporter Amy Scott told us about Governor Bobby Jindal's plans to overhaul the state's education system by creating a large-scale voucher system.
More than 50 years ago, free market economist Milton Friedman proposed a system of school vouchers. It would let parents use taxpayer money to send their kids to private schools. Opponents have long argued that vouchers take money from the schools that need it most. But today, Friedman's vision is gaining traction. Robert Enlow is president of the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice.
What's happened in the last 2 years is you had Indiana and Louisiana, between the two of them, make about 1 million kids eligible to receive public funds to go to schools that work better for them.
In Louisiana, low and middle income students in struggling schools will be able to use public money not just to pay for private school, but to do apprenticeships or take courses online. Leslie Jacobs served on the State Board of Education and now runs an education reform group. She says the problem is private schools receiving public money aren't accountable for how those children do when they get there.
If public money is going to follow these students, then the schools taking in and educating these students need to show that they're performing at a level higher than what a failing school would be.
A smaller voucher program in New Orleans has been popular with parents, but Jacob says student achievement has been mixed. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This piece hits on two of my favorite things about our shows. It looks at how big policy decisions impact everyday people. And it also made me want to learn more. I mean, what's going on with Louisiana's education system? How is New Orleans in particular doing post-Katrina? What are the pros and cons of vouchers? You know, I think that at Marketplace, we all hope our stories prompt listeners to ask these kinds of questions and really think deeply about crucial issues like education reform. On to the next piece. And it's one that definitely had an impact on listeners. Tucker Carlson's commentary about how we should pay for public radio. In his piece, he talks about the quote-unquote typical public radio listener. In short, the picture he paints is of someone who would definitely fit into the have column on the have and have nots chart. Let's listen to what Carlson had to say.
I love public radio. I listen to it every day. But sometimes, as I drive to my white-collar job in my expensive foreign car, surrounded by fellow public radio listeners driving to their white-collar jobs in their expensive foreign cars, I feel a little guilty. All of us are pretty affluent, I think to myself. Do we really need a federal subsidy? I live in Washington, D.C., but the scene would be familiar to anyone who lives in Winnetka, Illinois, the North Shore of Boston, or the West Side of L.A. In general, the richer the zip code, the more people tune in to public radio. Public radio listeners tend to have household incomes more than $30,000 above the national average. They're also whiter, better educated, and more than twice as likely as ordinary Americans to work in top management, not the profile of your average welfare recipient. Yet, in effect, that's what we are. Public radio receives more than $100 million a year in tax dollars. Teenage shift workers at McDonald's, harried single moms emptying waste baskets at law firms, farm workers picking lettuce in California, all are laboring so that you and I, you and your Prius, me and my Saab, can listen to a certain sort of educated news and opinion as we cruise in air-conditioned comfort to the office every day. Has there ever been a more unfair tax? Every few years, somebody in Congress tries to kill it. Public radio executives never quite defend their subsidy. That would be impossible to do with a straight face. But instead, they respond by pointing out that lots of people really, really like public radio. That's true. Of course, you could also say the same thing about the Rush Limbaugh show. And that's the point. When people like something, they will pay for it. Public radio listeners certainly could pay the whole tab for public radio. They just don't want to. Maybe, just to be decent, we should start.
We heard from a lot of listeners after this piece ran. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot. And they painted a very different picture of who they are.
Many wrote in to tell us that they are decidedly not that upper middle class listener that Carlson sketched out. We heard from people who identify as working poor, who work part-time because they can't find full-time work, public employees who make less than $30,000 a year, and even a listener who makes less than $10,000 a year. And on a side note, we now have a surprising amount of information on what kinds of cars our listeners drive.
I'm Mark Noyes. I live in Portland, Maine. I'd like to thank Tucker Carlson. I live in Maine, and I love public radio.
Jean Andreasen, St. Paul, Minnesota. Holy cats, I make less than $35,000 a year, drive a 19-year-old Volvo, take public transportation to work, and have been a faithful listener of NPR public radio for over 35 years. Clearly not the same demographic as Mr. Carlson.
I listen to public radio. I'm a student and making close to no money. I own no car, much less a foreign one. Even the $35 that my public radio station, the fantastic Maine public radio that Mr. Carlson calls home, is simply too much for me to pay.
In a democracy, it is our responsibility to ensure that our citizens are educated and well-informed. Public libraries, public schools, and public broadcasting fulfill that promise.
It is because of public radio and the Maine Public Broadcasting Company, provided in large part by people like Mr. Carlson, that I know as much about the world as I do today.
I am happy to pay taxes to support those institutions, and I'm proud to be a sustaining member of both my local public radio and television station.
This is something that's great about Marketplace. We have outspoken, vocal listeners who are not afraid to speak their minds. To check out the comments on this story and all of our stories, you can visit marketplace.org. We'd love to hear from you. That's it for this week's Remarket Podcast. I'm Megan Niebelacker, and I'm off to raise some more money for Marketplace.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.